This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, is there a pattern of misconduct leading to excessive force, discriminatory policing, and improper stops, searches, or arrests in many of America's cities, large and small? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. After the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, Eric Garner in New York City, and now Freddie Gray in Baltimore, Maryland, not to mention many others in between, communities across the country are asking these questions, leading many to demand federal investigations into their police departments. Baltimore exploded into violence on the evening of April 27th after several days of largely peaceful protests against Mr. Gray's treatment at the hands of Baltimore police. Gray suffered serious spine injuries and died in police custody. Six Baltimore police officers were criminally charged in the death of the 25-year-old African-American. As the case moves forward, a national discussion has emerged about the plight of inner-city residents in Baltimore and cities like it nationwide. Some say discriminatory housing policies, the decline of manufacturing, and the rise of mass incarceration are also to blame. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who is running for the Democratic presidential nomination, said too many black men have died at the hands of police. She is calling for broad changes to the criminal justice system, including the use of body cameras in every police department and reduced incarceration. The mayor of Baltimore asked the top U.S. law enforcement agency last week to investigate whether Baltimore's beleaguered police department uses excessive force and violates the rights of criminal suspects. The Justice Department's Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, who visited Baltimore last week, is said to be considering the mayor's request. The agency has carried out similar probes of police conduct in other cities. Well, for more on the underlying problems that plague Baltimore, as well as the next steps in implementing reforms to promote community policing, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Samuel Fullwood III is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Prior to joining the center, Sam was a journalist with prominent newspapers such as The Plain Dealer in Cleveland, The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and The Los Angeles Times, where in the 1990s he created a national race relations beat and contributed to the paper's Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of the L.A. riots in 1992. And Andrew Ferguson, he's an associate professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia, where he specializes in criminal law, criminal procedure, and evidence. Previously, Andrew was a public defender for 7 years, representing adults and juveniles in serious felony cases ranging from homicide to misdemeanor offenses. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you.
Thank you very much.
Well, Sam Fullwood, we've been here before, as I alluded to. Both of you were here when we talked about the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. And now here we are talking about Baltimore. And you've, of course, seen your share of riots. What's the same and what's different about what we witnessed in Baltimore, Sam?
There's been studies that have shown that nearly every incident of racial unrest in the United States was triggered by some sort of police activity. And I think that is the common thread that we have seen with Ferguson, with Baltimore, with New York, where there wasn't riots, and most certainly and dramatically with Los Angeles in 1992. Police interactions in urban communities tends to release pent-up anger and frustration, and sometimes that is a very combustible mix.
Turning to you, Andrew Ferguson, for your take on how what we just witnessed in Baltimore, riots leading to the destruction of so many businesses, the anger at the police after the death of Freddie Gray, what do you see as similar and different from that incident vis-a-vis the other ones we referred to?
I think there's a bubbling frustration among many people in inner city Baltimore and other places in America. One of the things you should note is that, you know, if Freddie Gray had not been tragically killed in the back of that police department car, he would have been arrested without a real reason. He really hadn't done anything wrong before the police stopped him. And what would have happened in the normal course is he would have been arrested, treated pretty badly, and then at best case for him, he would have been released. But that would cause some frustration. And that happens every single day in Baltimore and other cities where people are stopped, usually young men of color are stopped. They're arrested correctly or incorrectly and released, and they're not treated well. And that frustration builds and builds and builds until something like this happens when there's a tragic death, and then it explodes.
Back to you, Sam Fullwood. Certainly the constant, as both of you mentioned, is the way the police interact in these urban environments. And we can call it police brutality. This is a common thread. But interestingly, in Baltimore, let's talk about the makeup of the city in contrast to Ferguson, Missouri, where you had primarily white community officials and the police department was not that integrated either, predominantly white police department patrolling in urban areas with minority communities. But Baltimore was different.
Well, yes and no. I think what you're really pointing to is Baltimore is a predominantly black population. It has a black civil leadership that is the mayor. I think about half of the police force is African American. But that's not the issue. And if you hear a lot of people in Baltimore talk about it, a lot of people in the street protests before it got violent were saying this isn't a racial issue. What it is in many ways, it may be a class issue. It may be a clash of cultures and ways in which people see it. But I think there's something else that really needs to be pointed out. And when we talk about the parallels between what's happened in the past and what's happening now, in 92 or 91, when Rodney King was beaten, people saw it because someone videotaped. And that was the first time that sort of being able to see the brutality happen by a civilian camera person showing it was novel, just really was revolutionary. And it changed people's perception about what potentially police were doing, because prior to that, whatever police said, their word was sacrosanct. Flash forward to almost 25 years later in Baltimore, there were scores of people out with cameras during the protest and other situations. Now, there wasn't an actual camera picture of Freddie Gray being killed, but they're all beaten. Or harmed in any way, but there were pictures of him during his arrest. The way in which the media today, in its sort of omnipresent way, depicts these stories has a lot to framing the narrative of how we see it. So it makes people think, well, it's different in Baltimore because it's a black city, but it hides the notion that there is something very wrong with the interactions in a community, even if half the police who arrested Freddie Gray were black.
Turning to you, Andrew Ferguson, actually Sam Folwood underscored the very point I did want to make, that notwithstanding the mayor is black in Baltimore, that at least half of the police force, or a good portion of it, is also made up of black police officers, that still the constant is this sense that the police are out of control to some extent. Again, we know their job is very difficult, especially in urban areas. But this pattern that we seem to be seeing of excessive use of force, the rush to use force before resorting to other methods, and even arresting people on false grounds, etc. This seems to be the common thread. So I think that's an interesting point.
I agree. I think that this is really an indictment of policing and the different strategies that are used in policing. There are other alternatives in policing. There's community policing. There's more of a sense that we can be part of this community rather than policing it in a really excessive force, zero tolerance way, which is what I think we're seeing in Baltimore. And I think the protests are a response to that disrespect of police officers to the citizens that they are there to serve and protect. But as you say, being a police officer, especially in urban Baltimore, is a very difficult and dangerous job. And so you can understand why there could be tensions between the citizens and the police. But there are better ways to resolve those tensions. And my great hope, and maybe naive hope, is that this discussion, national discussion, international discussion, will cause people to rethink how we focus our policing, that this militarization of police, this idea of coming in and using force. I mean, again, Freddie Gray, according to the police's own report, saw the police and ran. And that was it. There was no crime. There was no suspicion. There was no justification. And he was stopped. And the law allows the police to stop him based on reasonable suspicion. But he shouldn't have been beaten, and he shouldn't have been handcuffed, and he shouldn't have been hurt, even if the police did believe he might be up to something, which they, again, there was no evidence that he was doing anything wrong. But it's that rush to judge and then use physical force in that way that I think is really something that we need to begin questioning, whether there aren't better ways.
I want to point out that the police have a difficult job, and I think their job is made all the more difficult by what I call sort of a clash of cultures in urban communities. The police are not there, grossly stated. They're not there really to protect and serve the people who are residents in the inner city. They're there to protect and serve the interest of voters or the political elites in a community. And that's where the real frustration comes, because people like Freddie Gray, I'm assuming, see the difference.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Samuel Fullwood. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, from whom you just heard. He was a former journalist with several American newspapers. And Andrew Ferguson, he's associate professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia, where he specializes in criminal law, criminal procedure, and evidence. And I'm Carol Castiel. We're discussing the need for nationwide reforms in community policing and the criminal justice system in the aftermath of the death of Freddie Gray and the unrest in the city of Baltimore. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with me on Facebook via Carol Castiel VOA. And please send us feedback by email as well to encounter@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Well, back to you, Andrew Ferguson. We want to talk about many things, some of the underlying factors in Baltimore, the unemployment, the declining, you know, economic base of the city, which may have contributed, et cetera, to the anger and the riots. But back to the so-called policing. Both of you have been bringing this point up that we've seen over the last decade, the militarization of the police force. And Sam brought up a very good point about previously we didn't have video cameras and everybody snapping with their iPhones, witnesses to police behavior, many times brutality. So now that there's going to be a federal probe into police conduct in Baltimore, what does that mean for Baltimore? What have we seen in other cities that have been under federal investigation?
Well, I think, you know, the connection between the use of cameras, individual iPhone cameras, and the federal investigation is all about a form of accountability. It's trying to bring some transparency and accountability to the police. And it could be through individuals who are sort of witnessing this. And I think we looked through the history of the civil rights movement, being a witness, having the cameras down at the marches at Selma and other places is what changed in large measure the way people viewed what was going on and had been going on before the cameras actually took those photos. It's the same thing here. What is interesting about the federal investigations that have been going on police forces is that they're really looking systematically at these pattern and practices of the police departments. They're looking, is there a use of excessive force? And just for some figures, in Baltimore in the last 3 years, 2011 to 2014, there were 102 civil lawsuits over police brutality that cost the citizens of Baltimore $5.7 million. And that's a lot of police brutality cases. So I think that they will, the federal investigations led by the new Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, will be able to review and see if there is a real problem. In Ferguson, the report, which I have to say is one of the few government reports that really wasn't attacked once it came out, people accepted that this was done very thoroughly, very intelligently, and really changed the dialogue to see that there were some underlying problems in Ferguson that had to do with the overuse of arrests, the use of fines, this whole civil forfeiture world that they were essentially financing municipal courts on the backs of poor people. And that was only discovered in some way, I won't say accidentally, but somewhat accidentally due to the tragic death of Michael Brown. And I imagine that when the federal government brings their investigatory team to Baltimore, they will also uncover some patterns and practices that can be improved, and that will be a measure of accountability and transparency for Baltimore and the nation.
Turning to you, Sam Fullwood, how do you see the potential federal probe of the Baltimore police force, and what do you expect that it may uncover?
Well, I agree with Andrew that the federal government has a lot of power to come in and sort of shine a spotlight on what's going on there. I am somewhat less sanguine about it simply because we've seen this before. In Los Angeles, for example, which I'm more familiar with, the federal government came in. There was civil suits even after the criminal suits failed to indict the four police officers. But yet, the community response, the community embrace and trust of police and the governmental officials there did not all of a sudden improve. That's my worry in Baltimore and in other places, is that, yes, I think there will be some changes, lots of changes perhaps, but what it really has to happen is some of the things that you talked about a minute ago, the living conditions of people in Baltimore, the social structure, the kind of day-to-day existence that people have really shapes their perceptions of the community. People do not riot in places that they love. They don't do that. They only riot when they feel frustrated and feel that they have no stake in the community that they're in. Now, that may be the community that they actually sleep in. but it's not because they love it. And I think that that's what we see, is that people don't trust, they don't love, they don't feel comfortable in the environment, and it creates or contributes to the frustrations. Until we get at some of those root causes of poverty, lack of opportunity, joblessness, those kinds of things really have to be addressed. And I haven't heard that conversation begun yet.
I'm glad you brought that up. Sam, now, of course, you answered my question, which was, do you think a conversation like that is going to take place? Because as you said, that is part and parcel of what has to happen, particularly in Baltimore. The manufacturing base has declined enormously. Many prominent African Americans left the city after the riots in 1968.
Not only African Americans, but prominent citizens of all stripes left, yes.
So again, in any contrast to other cities that have actually been successful with maybe not the same, but similar conditions, I was reading recently in the newspaper about Pittsburgh, for example, saying that Pittsburgh had a similar problem. They lost a manufacturing base with the steel mills, but somehow it transformed itself. There was a political will in the community, transformed itself from a steel city to a high tech. They're manufacturing, yes, but they're manufacturing different kinds of materials that are used in our economy today. And they've invested in the city and education.
I do think the opportunity is there. And where there's an opportunity, there can be the hope that it'll happen. Politically, this kind of conversation is, at least in Washington, is a non-starter. Our deadlocked government, which is predominantly controlled by conservative Republicans, have no appetite for public investments. And it will take a sort of public-private partnership of investments to be able to make this happen. And I'm not hearing that conversation. It could happen. I mean, Baltimore, I lived in Baltimore for several years back in the 80s, and Baltimore has a very prideful civic community and culture, both within the philanthropic and within the business community. And I think a lot of them would be alarmed to sort of see what's happening there and would want to try to bring about some changes in that community. I just haven't heard that conversation yet. I'm hopeful that we will get around to that.
Turning to you, Andrew Ferguson, for your take on these underlying problems of poverty, which have exacerbated this whole situation in Baltimore with the policing. We note that in the 1990s, there was a black mayor who was interested in investing in the city. There was a $130 million investment. But again, we don't see the fruits of that. So that doesn't mean it shouldn't be done again, but perhaps with different goals and in a different fashion. Are you hearing the conversation? Or like Sam, you haven't heard much talk about that, because, of course, this is going to be a multi-pronged approach to try to get to the roots of the problem.
I think, sadly, I agree that we haven't heard much of that dialogue yet. I think we've been focused on the legal issues, and I think that the legal issues are important, but sometimes a bit distracting. Whatever happens to the police officers who have been in charge at this moment, it's not going to address the underlying poverty and frustration of the young youth who were rioting. And seems like a fix, because we sort of use the legal system as a mechanism of accountability, but it's not getting to the real problems of accountability. And unless we do invest in education and jobs and in building a community culture where citizens, you know, feel that they can trust the police and their government, we're going to be in the same situation when the next incident happens.
Do you agree with Sam Fulwood that there's not much of an appetite for that right now in the country at the national level, with gridlock in Congress and with a, you know, predominantly conservative legislature, with the Republicans in charge of both the House and the Senate? Or somehow can Baltimore itself as a city, with the very prominent Johns Hopkins Medical Center there and other private-public partnerships, can they somehow begin this investment process despite what's going on at the national level?
I think that it might make more sense to look at the state level. And I think one of the difficulties is that the Maryland state, which is run by a rather progressive legislature, also has a new Republican governor who has promised to essentially cut taxes, although I think he's having some difficulty getting his tax plan through. But that's not the sort of centerpiece of investment and looking at the problem. So I would look and hope that the Maryland politicians would see this as a priority and would realize they need to invest in order to not drive more businesses out of Baltimore, and in fact, to encourage them to come in. So, again, I don't know if we have moved to that part of the conversation yet. And my fear is with the legal discussions, we might not get to that because people will think, oh, there's a legal process, accountability has been done, we can move on. But that's simply a Band-Aid over a much deeper wound.
I want to point out, too, that perception plays a really big part in it. We refer to what happened last week in Baltimore as youth rioting. That's the way it's been categorized in media. And we talked about, you know, all of the property damage that has been done. The fact of the matter is that there has been less property damage and less dollar damage in the city of Baltimore in the wake of Freddie Gray's death than there was after the Baltimore Ravens won the Super Bowl. There was more destruction in the city in the rioting, which is not defined as rioting. It's, you know, youthful exuberance or celebration. Mm-hmm. That goes a long way in terms of how people portray and characterize the opportunity in Baltimore. You destroy your community because you're celebrating a football game. People want to rush in and feel very good about that. You have a disturbance in your community because of people's frustration with the way they live, and now people want to take their business out and they want to withdraw. Those are perceptions, and I think in large measure some of those perceptions are fueled by the way in which this is portrayed in the media, by the way in which people talk about it, the language that we use to sort of characterize what's going on, and I think some of that has to be changed. Those are the kinds of things that, you know, without regard to the criminal part of it or the social economic structure of it, that ordinary citizens can have a part in trying to speak up and say, no, this is the difference.
Well, very good point. Well, back to you, Andrew Ferguson. Going back to police tactics, to what extent police behavior is on the verge of changing? Are we at a watershed moment from when the so-called zero tolerance policies were in effect, broken windows? And, of course, we're referring to police in cities, you know, aggressively arresting people for minor crimes. We saw that with the Eric Garner case in New York City when he was allegedly unlawfully selling illegal cigarettes. And then the guy was in a chokehold and shouting, you know, I can't breathe. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to ever forget that. Is this going to be a trigger for more community policing, getting back to the days when the police interacted with the communities, were not seen as the enemy and not seen as something to be feared? I'm a lady. I walk down the street and sometimes I see the police and they scare me, or I don't see them necessarily as my protector. Is this going to be something that we're going to see, a rethinking of policing in this country?
Well, I think the conversation has changed. I'm not optimistic that these large-scale problems will necessarily change, but we've seen such a pattern, and the media, both for good and bad, has fueled this focus where we are now having that conversation, which we really weren't having before. I mean, one of the things I think is so striking about the Freddie Gray case is that this type of situation where a young man is in an urban area, a high-crime area, as it's called, and sees a police officer and then runs, the Supreme Court has said that police are allowed to stop him, legally, constitutionally allowed to stop him based on reasonable suspicion because those two factors, high-crime area and unprovoked flight, is enough for suspicion. And that causes some real problems because it encourages the kind of policing that we saw that led to Freddie Gray's death. And so my hope is that we will be examining what police are doing and recognizing that while police body cameras is a step, it's not going to be a panacea. It's not. We saw with Eric Garner, having cameras there helps, but certainly doesn't solve the problem. And that we really need to rethink how police are trained, how citizens interact with police. It's not a one-way street. Obviously, citizens help create some of the distrust, and police are just human beings who react when people don't treat them nicely. And so I think that we really need to do some sort of community soul searching about how we can deal with these problems. You know, one of the realities is because we have ended and sort of minimized the availability of other social services, we use police for a lot of first responder situations where it's not necessarily the right place to go. If you have a mentally ill person who's walking naked in the street, is having an armed police officer really the person who should go confront that person? I'm not sure. I think actually that we should have mental health professionals who we could call instead of 911, we could call them, or those kinds of community-based approaches which will avoid the tension You know, when you're a police officer and you're facing a dangerous situation, you don't have that many options. At least you're not trained to have that many options, and we could change that as well. But it's foreseeable that these incidents will happen again and again unless we have some other alternatives for sort of diffusing some of the social unrest in a community. Sometimes that's due to mental illness. Sometimes that's due to poverty. Sometimes that's due to, you know, people making bad decisions. But none of those should end in the death of a citizen.
Turning to you, Sam Fulwood, for your view of how these incidents, particularly the Freddie Gray one, will perhaps trigger a reexamination of how we police communities. Will there be greater emphasis on community policing? And of course, Andrew Ferguson makes a very good point. The police have a difficult job, and now they're seen to, because there are fewer social services for many people, they're now called on to deal with mental ill people running, you know, on the streets who are potentially dangerous. It's not easy for them.
I would hope that this would spark a conversation about a return to community policing. But community policing is a really complex topic. In Baltimore, for example, I think the figure is somewhere around 70% of the police officers do not live in the city of Baltimore. Some of them come from as far away as Pennsylvania so that they work in the city and then they go someplace else to live. When you think of community policing, what you're thinking of is a cop that is a part of the community that he is protecting and serving. If Baltimore did not have police officers from outside of Baltimore, they probably wouldn't be able to maintain a police force at all. So it is a real challenge to get people who are not a part of a community to be invested in that community as if they are. That's the real challenge. And I don't know. At this point, I just really don't know. I think that what it's going to take going forward and over a period of years, maybe decades, is that we have to have a different change in terms of the public will for how we view our communities. And that change of public attitude, a willingness to invest, that is, raise taxes and spend money to solve some of these pressing problems, we're not there yet. Will it take incidents like Freddie Gray or Ferguson to do that? Well, I think they move us closer, sadly, but we're not there by a long shot.
And the last word to you, Andrew Ferguson, moving us on to the question of these police officers and the fact that they were charged, many of them, of course, astounded, denying that they did anything wrong. And then there were critiques that perhaps there was a rush to charge them to appease the protesters. What is your view of what the next steps will be with regard to the trial of these officers and the death of Freddie Gray? Do you think they can receive a fair trial?
Well, I think that, again, the Freddie Gray incident reveals some common elements of our criminal justice system that play out all the time but are now just getting attention. It is pretty common for prosecutors to charge essentially the highest charge they possibly could charge at the outset, in part because it's very difficult to ever go up again once you've charged. So it's not uncommon to charge any defendant with the most that the prosecution thinks they reasonably could get a grand jury to indict on. But this is the initial charge. It may not actually stand up. There will likely either be a preliminary hearing or a grand jury in the next 45 days, I believe, in Maryland. And it could be the case that some of these charges will be reduced. There's already been discussion in the media about whether or not the arrests were unlawful based on what kind of knife it was, based on Baltimore law or state law, and those things will get resolved. I think that the political attacks, meaning that the attacks at the prosecution's decision was political, I think there's some truth to that. I think it had a positive effect of stopping the unrest, but I also think that we have a legal system where all of these issues will get resolved. And I would imagine, because the police have good lawyers and because people will be paying attention, they will get a fair shot at justice. And I would imagine, if I were to predict, that the charges would come down pretty significantly and that we wouldn't be seeing a second-degree murder charge, a depraved heart murder charge. But we'll see how the system plays out after the next few steps in the legal system.
And we'll certainly be following the aftermath of Freddie Gray's death in Baltimore and bring you all the news in that regard in the coming weeks and months. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Sam Fulwood, he's Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Andrew Ferguson, Associate Professor of Law at the University of the District of Columbia. Thanks to both of you for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.